Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 134 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. About the number 134, UN Security Council Resolution 134 passed in 1960, condemning South Africa for large-scale killings of unarmed and peaceful demonstrators against racial discrimination and segregation. France and the UK, to their everlasting shame, abstained. It was more than 30 years later when apartheid finally collapsed. You can email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm, or download the program after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor this show as an individual or an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you would like me to speak at a meeting of an organization that you're a member of, on science, medicine, viruses, democracy, or other social issues, I'd be happy to discuss this opportunity with you. If you wish to donate, you can donate via PayPal using the email address david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Go to theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.php for more information. Feedback this week is on the Celia Farber podcast, number 132, and it came via the Podbean page, the Podbean podcast page. While I was there, I noticed that we've now exceeded 50,000 downloads. Greg wrote about the Celia Farber podcast, excellent, engrossing, not tangential at all. Lucho wrote, an interview worth listening to again. Thanks for that feedback, and please keep it coming. And now let's go to our guest. Philip Brass is of Salto, Cree and Scottish ancestry, and is a member of the Pipikisis, First Nation and Treaty 4 Territory in Saskatchewan. Philip is presently the community wellness coordinator for his people, where his primary focus is on holistic community health through local food initiatives, traditional land-based life practices and ceremony. He's also an avid hunter, fisherman, artist, and environmental advocate. His ideas and perspectives are increasingly sought on a broad range of social, economic, and environmental issues faced by Indigenous people today. I heard Philip being interviewed briefly on CBC, Canada's public broadcaster, and when he connected the modern Western diet of many natives today to diabetes and implied that the Indigenous diet could be a solution, I was interested. That discussion didn't continue down that path, but I want to do that now. Welcome to the show, Philip.
Thank you, David.
So first, who were the Indigenous groups in Canada's prairies prior to Western colonization?
Well, that's always been in flux. I mean, I'm not an archaeologist, but I mean, there were a number of smaller Indigenous linguistic groups that occupied, well, Hirarayam, which is now present-day Saskatchewan, Treaty 4 territory, which is the southern third of Saskatchewan, prior to the horse culture arriving in the early 1700s. I mean, there would have been different smaller linguistic groups that seem to have either been absorbed by larger tribal groups or vanished due to disease. But the Nakota were, and the Blackfeet were the earlier inhabitants of this region. Once the fur trade begun, Cree and Soto peoples from the east, coming out of present-day Ontario and Manitoba, pushed westward.
And a lot of these groups, like I live in Alberta, which is the province to the west of Saskatchewan, and the Nakota and the Blackfoot are also present here, and I believe down into Montana, and there was no 49th parallel in those days.
Well, of course. Yeah, you bet.
Yes. And so what were the characteristics of the prairie diet versus the diet in other, the native diet in other parts of Canada?
Well, I mean, the bison was the central staple of the plains diet. You know, but I mean, our ecosystems here in, on the plains, I mean, they're obliterated by agriculture now. So mm-hmm. to understand just how rich and diverse the prairie ecosystems were, I mean, it was teeming with life at one time. So as far as an animal based, you know, meat diet, there was a diverse group of animals to rely on, and plants.
Right. Was fish an important component?
Absolutely. Yeah. No. I mean, fish has always been a big, whether it's even in the northern regions, but here on the plains as well.
So, what were some of the plants that were either eaten or used for medicine that people might?
Well, the medicinal plants are, I mean, they're numerous. I mean, that is a very rich medicine chest of plants on the plains that are still used today. As far as foods, I mean, I'm not a food forager myself, but I mean, I do. There are people I know who are more knowledgeable on that. But I mean, I know that the birch tree did. There's a flower made from that. There's also the cattails.
Right. They grow in swamps, yes.
Yeah, and it's very corn-like.
I presume there's a lot of tubers
with
the roots of lilies and things, but you have to know what you're doing because some lilies, for example, are quite poisonous.
Yep, you bet. Plus, we also had trade. You know,
right.
There was significant trade routes.
And was it totally a barter economy, or were there forms of money in the economy back then?
Oh, as far as I know, it would just been a barter. I'm not entirely sure.
Yes, different groups.
Yeah.
And from what I've read about early reports of white men meeting natives for the first time, they commented on just how strong and healthy they were. That's not to say that everybody at all times was strong and healthy, because I'm sure there were periods of famine and disease and all kinds of bad things. But today, I mean, natives are often seen as a sick population with a lot of diabetes and addiction issues and things like that. What are the components of those changes in health?
Yeah, well, I mean, that shift in health is a direct effect of diet. And there's all sorts of early documentation of that. I mean, when Europeans first arriving, I mean, the average indigenous person here was much taller, much more robust than mm-hmm. the average European at the time. You know, in those centuries, I mean, Europeans were actually quite unhealthy people, you know, with...
Well, they would have had, probably Europeans would have had a much more carbohydrate intensive diet.
Well, yeah, they would have, yeah, and sugars, right, and flours and these sorts of things that do weaken the body. So, I mean, yeah, there's documentation, I mean, of indigenous peoples here on the plains. I mean, in you know, 300 years ago, I mean, they were 6 feet tall when your average European man was 5'5", you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, there's been a direct correlation with the disappearance of the buffalo. And here in Saskatchewan here, I mean, that would have been in the late 1860s. And, you know, within one generation, you began to see a weakening of the bodies and the dental structure.
Right.
Weakened, and immune systems weakened.
Mm-hmm.
Once we were placed on reserves, and forced to rely on a ration diet, which usually consisted of white flour and salt pork.
Right. I mean, the bison were incredibly numerous, and so it probably would have been quite a high protein diet. plus supplemented by fish, and there are also lots of other animals like antelopes and deer that I presume would have been.
Yeah, you bet, and small game birds. But I think the huge loss of knowledge is that plant knowledge. I mean, there was quite a diverse range of plant foods that were available, and would have been part of that diet.
Right, and I mean, are there people? I know when I was studying biology many years ago, there were some biologists, I think mostly Westerners, who were studying sort of the indigenous or studying plants from a point of view of what their uses were for food or medicine and things like that. But is there any kind of effort amongst indigenous peoples to reclaim that knowledge, some of which might have even been almost lost or totally lost?
Absolutely. Well, here in Saskatchewan at the Wanuskewin Center, just outside of Saskatoon, Glenda Abbott is someone who's very knowledgeable in medicinal plants and plant foods, and they do a lot of workshops and have some a gardening program there where they are bringing back some of that traditional knowledge around our plant-based foods.
Right, and I also think it's important psychologically for all peoples to be in touch with their past, and does this include like educating children on what their native botanical culture was?
Yeah, I believe they do. I believe they do have programs for school age children.
Yeah. So when I hear about diabetes, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's a huge problem amongst Native peoples today.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So you hear two things. I mean, mostly I hear that they're looking for some genetic cause of this, and then the other is to talk about diet. I don't know what you think about the genetic cause, but it seems strange to me that a healthy people would suddenly be struck by diabetes if it was genetic. Like, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, well, myself, I mean, I'm not too sure if you're familiar with the Weston A. Price Foundation or Dr. Weston A. Price's
Yeah,
work.
Actually, I think I wrote an article for website, or not for him, I guess he's dead many years, but for his website or something on the West Nile virus several years ago. But yeah, tell me about what you know about the Western Price Foundation.
Well, I've just seen some documentaries on him some years back, you know, and it made some sense to me to mm-hmm. see how he had documented those shifts in health outcomes directly related to diet in indigenous groups around the world, whether it be in South America, Asia, even Europe, and I believe it was Inuit people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same here, right? I mean, that shift in our health, you know, is very measurable within one generation of being introduced to white flour and sugar.
Yes, I remember reading a book that studied some islands in Scotland, and on one side of the island they had a town and a store and they had food coming over, but on the other side of the island it was pretty much the traditional mm-hmm. traditional diet. And he looked specifically, this author, I think his name was Davies, looked at the dental status. And it was hugely different. The people on the western side eating a traditional diet had very good dentition, and the people on the east side, where they were exposed to sugar and refined flour, had very high rate of calories and malformed teeth or misshapen dentition, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. And to see that, you know, most of these indigenous cultures all usually had one or several fermented foods, as well as organ meats. Organ meats, I think, are a huge hole in our diet now. I mean, even in First Nations communities, You know, a lot of our people aren't eating those organ meats, which are really where the core of maintaining robust health.
Yes, I mean the idea is if you incorporate meat. I mean, I think the Western diet has gotten worse over time. And we on this program we've talked about this in the 1950s they went for this low fat diet. So they have all these people that won't eat red meat and they don't want fat in their diet, and they certainly don't want to eat liver or kidneys or heart. Or things that used to be even part of the Western diet. Like as a kid, my mother would serve us, I think she served us brains once, and we had liver quite frequently, and kidney and things like that, but a lot of that is gone.
Yeah.
So are we really talking about what a lot of people call the paleo diet?
Well, perhaps.
I mean, that's supposed to be things
I mean, I don't know how much the paleo diet focuses on organ meats. I mean,
I think that's part of it. I mean, I guess there's no point in getting hung up on terminology.
Right.
It's like what the diet is more important than how you classify it.
Yeah, I mean, it's all regional, too. I mean, you have, with every different ecosystem around the world, you're going to have different foods available. So, I mean, it's... you know, what people might call the paleo diet from, you know, ancient peoples in Europe, you know, comparatively to, you know, indigenous peoples here 300 years ago. I mean, there's going to be quite a difference in what they would have been.
Right. Well, in the prairies, you're dealing with the bison, but I assume that when a bison was killed, that pretty much everything was either eaten or used for some other function.
Yeah, you bet. Bone marrow, everything. Yeah.
Right. We didn't really talk about the fermented foods, but that's something that's completely new to me. I did not know that indigenous people in North America fermented foods. So can you talk about that a little bit?
I don't have a large amount of knowledge around that here on the plains. Although, I mean, there was... the use of berries for preserving food and pemmican. There would have been a certain amount of fermentation involved with that.
I believe even like sausages, like Western sausages, it goes through some kind of bacterial process with lactobacteria, which would probably disgust most Westerners. I mean, many people probably don't even know that cheese is formed by bacteria and fungus.
Yep.
And... they want to live in a world where there's no bacteria, maybe less now, people are a bit better educated, but bacteria are really important at converting something into something else that's more digestible.
Right.
And I mean, people are maybe more familiar, like in Korea, kimchi is like a critical part of the diet, and I think in a northern climate, it produced vitamin C for them in... the winter. I assume that native people must have had some way to generate vitamin C when they went through very long winters on the prairies.
Yeah, you would have had to, but I also think that there would have been, I'm not too sure how much wintering would have gone on in the prairies prior to the horse. You know, I think that there would have been seasonal movement out onto the plains and then retreating back into forested areas during winter times.
Right, but even so, I mean, even in a forested area, I know people used to use spruce needles and things like that for vitamin C, but still getting nutrients in the winter must have been a challenge apart from animals.
Yeah, I'd imagine it would be.
Yes. So what's on a Canadian native reserve, what kind of foods are available if you go to the store?
Well, I mean, that can vary. I mean, that's a huge country.
Mm-hmm.
The different First Nations communities are very different from one another. Here in my community, there's absolutely nothing. We have a gas station. It has nothing but pop and chips.
Right.
I think they briefly tried to sell milk and white bread, but... really couldn't maintain that. grocery stores in the area and surrounding towns are very expensive and right. do not provide a really much for healthy choices. I mean, they have very limited amounts of vegetables, fruits and vegetables.
Right.
Difficult to find any whole grain breads.
Right.
So yeah, I believe we live in a food desert here in our heck of the woods.
And yet, it used to be one of the food paradises when the bison were there, but it wasn't
absolutely.
Just the bison. Lots of other things. You're a hunter, so what kinds of foods do people go out and get today?
We hunt moose, elk, deer, rabbits, prairie chickens, and rough grouse,
mm-hmm.
and fish, either northern pike, walleye, or whitefish.
Right. And what are the challenges? I mean, not only were the bison exterminated and were, you know, many parts of the prairies occupied by farms for wheat or barley or something like that, but you have a legal right to hunt and gather on Crown lands and obviously on your reserve. That's correct?
Yeah, you bet.
So what have been the changes to Crown lands over the years in terms of your ability to access traditional foods?
Well, technically under treaty, in Treaty 4 territory, the Treaty 4 was signed between Cree and Soto nations with the Crown in 1874. In that, we retained our inherent right to hunt and gather throughout all of Treaty 4 territory. 2 years later, came the Indian Act. By 1882, we were all rounded up and placed and incarcerated on reservations. And then came 1930, the Resource Transfer Agreement, where the federal government devolved all resource jurisdiction to the province. All in the meanwhile, Indigenous peoples were still incarcerated on First Nations or on reserves under the PASS system. So that was over the course of 71 years. We were not allowed to even leave our reservations without a PASS.
So what can you describe?
Up until 1951. So during all that time, we were not able to hunt on Crown lands throughout our treaty territory or anywhere other than within our communities. And we're refounded here in southern Saskatchewan because the places that our reserves were located, they wouldn't have enough game to sustain people.
Yeah, I mean, reserves are not that large chunks of
land. No, they're
large.
Very small. Most of them are very small. And of course, on the prairie here, most of our reserves were placed in places that weren't very rich with wildlife.
Right. A previous guest who was mostly talking about the residential schools told me that the reserves were deliberately placed as far away from the railroad as possible to try to prevent natives from developing an economy that would be successful.
Yeah, well, I mean, for instance, in my community here, which is Papiksis First Nation, there was a Indian agent by the name of William Graham, and about 1898, he began a experimental farming colony on our reserve, where he brought residential school or industrial school graduates from different locations, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, brought these young graduate men to the reserve, pushed the original band members to the north end of the reserve, divided the land into 80-acre plots, and they had a farming colony here which for some time was very successful, because it was a collective. And, but then they began to get pressure from surrounding settlers, farmers, because they couldn't compete with the farming colony. And so there was pressure to squash it, and so that happened.
And so, I mean, what would it seems to me that you could barely survive if you're cut off from your lands until the 1950s. You're limited to your reserve. There's a small amount of food on the reserve. I mean, were people basically dependent on charity from outside in terms of obtaining food and things like that?
Well, in our community here, I mean, up until the 1980s, I mean, most of the older generation were avid gardeners. You know, people grew their own food.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it's a systemic issue that has brought about a culture of dependence over the course of generations, but no fault of our own.
And I think on a broader scale, I think the culture of dependence, I mean, that's a phrase that comes up to my mind a lot. I think the medical system tries to make people dependent on the medical system, because a culture of dependence is very profitable for industrial interests. If you have to go to a store to buy food, somebody's making money. If you go and get your own food in the bush, nobody's making money. I mean, it's like breastfeeding versus formula. Breastfeeding doesn't add to the economy, and so industrial interests are not interested in it. They would much rather people were formula feeding, even though it's obviously not as healthy for mother or baby.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's where the concept of food sovereignty, you begin to hear that term now, indigenous communities and circles where people are reconnecting the dots and saying, you know, how do we assert our sovereignty as indigenous peoples? How do we put our the social fabric back together? How do we sew that back together in our communities? And people are realizing it's through food, it's through food culture. When by losing our food culture, everything else unravels. The social relationships. Everything unravels once we cease to grow food together. I mean, even our languages, the loss of our languages is also not only is it from the residential school system, but we see that a lot of our languages are rooted in those activities that were on the land, and usually when you're on the land, you're doing some sort of food gathering or processing. So linking those activities back to our language seems to help with language retention.
Right, and I mean, other challenges, things you hear about quite often in Native reserves are a high level of suicide amongst young people, which to me indicates there is a huge level of despair amongst people. Has anybody looked at how reconnecting with your culture has an impact on the suicide rate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's objective in a lot of our land-based curriculum that is being developed in some of our communities. I've said it for years. The big crisis for our youth is identity. In this age of pop culture and industrial dependence, as indigenous peoples, these young people who don't have their language, don't have any tangible connection to what an indigenous identity is, it leaves in especially in isolated communities, it leaves them in despair. I mean,
we all need purpose in our lives, and it's a lot easier if you live in a city. You can go to university or college, get a diploma or a degree, you can get a job, and then people tell you you're doing a good job. You kind of get that feedback, your life is meaningful. You're providing for your kids or things like that. And amongst natives, prior to the Europeans, I presume that men and women had roles and were admired for what they could do, whether it was hunting or growing food or gathering food or making clothing or things like that. As you say, that was probably the vast or a big significant part of their time was spent in these technologies or doing these things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, prior to contact, indigenous peoples were, first of all, they were sober. There was no alcohol. There was, these are highly, highly functioning social groups, family groups. You know, no one could be a slacker. I mean, it was
right.
the amount of skills and know-how in an intimate relationship with your surrounding ecosystem and all that it can provide was an incredible amount of knowledge. I mean, the amount of knowledge lost, I think it's immeasurable today.
Can you describe some technologies that were used by indigenous peoples to gather food or process food that people might not be aware of?
You know, one of the biggest links that Westerners, I think, fail to recognize about indigenous peoples is their incredible spiritual connection with the places that we lived and the what I would call divine guidance in developing some of the techniques in which we live by. This is even documented. There's an older book called Last of the Buffalo Hunters. It was about a Métis buffalo hunter who had been a young hunter on the plains here in the 1860s. He was interviewed in 1931 at about the age of 87. And he lived in Librette, Saskatchewan. But he pointed out how the Métis, who were predominantly Catholic, and were great buffalo hunters for a time in the 1800s. But how often the Métis would follow the local Cree or Soto or Nakota groups who were also hunting, because the indigenous peoples had ceremonies where they would were able to receive spiritual guidance as to even how to locate or where to locate the bison, that spiritual relationship with the spiritual consciousness of the plains was so acute and direct that's something that Western society does not recognize, because there's no parallel to it in Christianity or Western society.
I mean, that's interesting, because I was thinking of hunting the buffalo, processing the meat, but of course, first you got to find them, or whatever other animals you're looking for. And whenever I go out in the forest, I tend not to see anything. If I was to go out specifically looking for, say, a moose or a bear, I'm not sure where I would start. So I guess that's not really a technology, and maybe I'm being too Western and asking you about technologies. That's something completely different, but it's critically important.
For me, this is the defining component of what is an indigenous culture. We're talking about the term indigenous. It's an indigenous plant, an indigenous species. An indigenous human culture is a culture that acclimates to the natural carrying capacity and the ebb and flow of a specific ecological region. So it's through very observant, I would say almost scientific observation, but also indigenous peoples, you know, throughout the world. I mean, we have to understand, we are all, no matter whether you're a Caucasian European, we are all, the blood quantum-wise, we are all the descendants of indigenous cultures.
Mm-hmm.
It's empire, which is only a economic system that has wiped out indigenous cultures and knowledge and spiritual practices and connection. An indigenous culture really is first and foremost about maintaining and practicing a spiritual relationship with an ecological region.
That's
an understanding that, right, that there are spiritual beings that reside within an ecological region that we can interact with. That will give us wisdom. That will give us direction. And, I mean, direct, not just ideology, but actual specific instruction.
Right. That's interesting, because you don't really think of Western religions try to pretend that they're kind of divorced from daily life. You don't go to church thinking, I'm going to come out, being able to grow my crops better, right? They might
there is that, but you don't go in and say, where are the buffalo, and actually get an answer.
Right, right.
And where within our indigenous peoples, that practice, that was the practice.
Right. So, you're basically saying spirituality and life were intimately linked. There wasn't
You bet. It's the absolute core of indigenous culture is that spiritual relationship. And not only did some of our technologies and techniques develop through trial and error, but often through direct instruction.
Right. I remember reading a book, I think it was written in the 1930s, I think it's a little bit famous, I just came across it randomly, which was on the evolution of the snowshoe and the ski. And the skis tend to be European, but the snowshoe developed in mm-hmm. North America. And the book kind of connected the types of snowshoes with the type of snow that was present. Whereas on the prairies, if I remember correctly, the snowshoes were kind of round and quite small because the snow is quite compact, whereas in the boreal forests where the snow is very loose and deep, they were much larger and more narrow, so you could get through the trees.
Mm-hmm.
But that presumably developed over time when people used their creativity and, as you say, their spiritual knowledge to try to live better, to survive better under harsh conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. And you find in, I would say, I mean, I don't know all indigenous languages in present-day Canada, but I mean, in most indigenous languages, there's many, many, many different terms and terminologies for snow, depending on what type of snow it is, right?
Where right.
You won't find that level of description within English language.
Well, there is a sort of a culture of mountaineers who, because to a mountaineer, of course, the different kinds of snow is important, whereas to the ordinary people in the city, it's just snow, right? They don't care. But if you're up in a mountain, it's critically important. Is this snow nice and solid? Am I going to be able to get up it? Is it, so they've developed a terminology, but they go home and then it doesn't matter anymore. But to native peoples, the snow was critically important to getting around and even constructing shelters and things like that. One of the things I was thinking is that the difference between Western culture and native culture was so dramatic that the Western culture was largely incompatible. If you look at the economy of the West, it's based on private ownership, and whereas native culture was based on a sharing economy. Am I correct?
Yeah, you bet.
So land was not seen as this belongs to this person. It's a community resource which you use when the time is right. When you're going to pick berries, you're going to hunt bison, you would use different parts of the land at different times. So you also needed a huge amount of land to survive on, because you couldn't intensively cultivate on a small small plot of private land.
Well, yeah, and therein lies the sustainability aspect, right? I mean, being being very observant of the natural carrying capacity of a certain ecological region would affect decisions around even birth rates, understanding what was sustainable and adhering to those natural laws is fundamentally different from Western civilization that is based on infinite growth and human centricity, right, where the rights of wildlife and other what we would call our other life relatives is
right.
not a part of the equation. And so as Indigenous peoples, we've stood by and watched perhaps in horror as we watch industrial society's infinite growth model now coming to a place where here with over 7 billion people on the planet, climate
yes.
change, all a direct consequence of an infinite growth ideology.
I was talking to somebody a couple of days ago about the pharmaceutical industry, and I commented that they're trapped in this. We have to increase our profits every year, and that means they have to sell more drugs every year. They just can't sell the same amount. They just can't make $10 billion every year, $10 billion this year, $10 billion next year. Next year they have to make 10.5 or 11, or
right.
they'll lose their job, right? You can't, static is bad. And yet, I mean, one of the characteristics of Indigenous peoples was stability, because if the population grew 10 years, 100 years down the road, you wouldn't be able to feed everybody.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and therein lies this myth that has been perpetrated by Western civilization to refer to Indigenous cultures as primitive. When in fact, I believe the opposite is true. Indigenous cultures were so highly developed in a spiritual way. The wisdom, the accumulative knowledge of that Indigenous cultures held and practiced. I mean, the sustainability of these Indigenous cultures that it sustained for millennia. That's not primitive. That is highly intelligent and wise. And
right.
There's always this focus on, well, how complex was your technology? Well, sometimes that. The more technologically advanced a society might be, actually is its Achilles heel, right? I mean, it's going to be its own undoing, as any empire rises and falls because of that. Because of usually at the core of it, it's human centric. It only wants to.
Well, I think Western culture likes to establish its own metrics, and so, like. I was saying to you earlier, I moved to Canada when I was 9 as a child, and so I started to learn a little bit about Indigenous culture. And certainly Indigenous cultures had technologies like snowshoes, but anything that wasn't based on steel and based on manufacturing was looked down on. Well, that's not really technology. Imagine somebody today who's working in the service economy, they have a job at Walmart or 7-Eleven or something like that. I mean, what do they need to do in a day? They need to be able to work with money. They need to know what products are in the store. And that's not a very wide range of knowledge in order to survive in this low-wage economy. Whereas a native person would have had to know what time of the year do you go after what foods? Where are those foods? How do you process those foods, which ones are safe to eat, which ones are poisonous, things like that. Like, that could potentially be an enormous encyclopedia of knowledge.
Absolutely.
But it wasn't written, and so the rules of Western civilization are, if it's not written down, it's primitive.
Yeah, and I mean, and we, I think we, our education institutions, you know, are very narrow and are very limited. And, you know, I think we tell ourselves that we know more than we actually really do. I mean, we have the situation, I mean, we all drive these cars, but how many of us would actually know how to build our own car? You know, even a toilet. I mean, tell me exactly, how does a toilet work? You know, could you build your own? You know, we've built this industrial matrix where it's very easy to survive. There's a very limited amount of knowledge you need to, as an individual, to actually acquire in order to be able to navigate this.
Yeah, I think in some ways we're going backwards, because a lot of the, you know, industrial society is making these products that means we have to do less. We don't have to read a book. We can watch television instead. We don't have to walk. We can take a car. And all of these things are really bad for us, but the easy way is to just follow along with what the society wants to give us for their benefit, not ours. What changes are, there's been very big changes in indigenous culture, and like you said, the end of the past system in the 50s. I was just reading about the time when Native people couldn't vote without giving up their Native status. There's been some big advances, as well as really negative things, like the number of Natives, women and men who've disappeared, who've been murdered, and nobody seems to care. Like, what do you see are trends in Indigenous culture in Canada, either positive or negative?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a juggernaut of a question.
I guess it's kind of a big question, but let's talk about some good things. Like, what do you see in Native cultures in terms of, say, reclaiming parts of their culture that are having a positive impact, moving Indigenous culture forwards into a better place?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's always a matter of perspective. What do we call success, right? I mean, from a Canadian perspective, I think assimilation is always heralded as, oh, what a great and wonderful thing, you know. But for myself, I like to see there is a growing consciousness, a resurgence of consciousness around the concept of what we call decolonization, which is just simply becoming aware of much of what you and I are talking about right now. It's understanding human culture systems, you know, indigenous culture versus industrial culture, or versus empirical culture. Being able to unpack that question in the 21st century, I think, is vitally important, as we are all searching for a sustainable model to take us forward. So exploring that in our Indigenous communities is really exciting. To begin to try to build food systems in our communities, local food systems, linking our languages back to those systems, our education, developing land-based education curriculum, land-based classrooms for our youth. I think that's an exciting consciousness that I see is taking root in a lot of our communities.
One thing I've observed as an outsider is the rediscovery of pride in your culture, which I think was diminished greatly when children were sent to residential schools, when their language was suppressed, their cultural practices were suppressed. The message from the the Western society was everything you do is bad and primitive. And I see that as a big change as an outsider. I don't know if you agree with that.
Well, of course. Yeah. The effects of colonialism are still a huge factor in our communities. I mean, I can't speak for all our people in our communities. We have different camps, different ideologies. I mean, there still is those who are deeply involved with church institutions who mm-hmm. might look back at the residential school systems as a good thing. I mean, we even have a Canadian senator this week. I'm not too sure if you're aware, but there's a Canadian senator who is, trying to... what was she saying? She was saying something about, focusing on the positives of the residential school system, which is... a horrific thing to say, because and there again, I think a lot of Canadians fail to understand what the actual tragedy of the residential school system is. And there's always this focus on the actual survivors themselves and trying to measure how much abuse one individual may have suffered themselves or not.
I think there's a big focus.
When actually the greater tragedy is the loss of culture, and how the intergenerational effects of that. That's the greater tragedy. It's when an Indigenous peoples no longer value their land-based life practices or their languages. That's the great tragedy.
Yes, because if these children had been left at home, they would have been learning to hunt, to fish, to make shoes and clothing with the materials that they gathered. They would have been learning the language, which, as you point out, is tightly connected with all of those practices. They would have had their own spirituality, which is also connected. And I don't think it's any... And I agree with you. It's like, obviously, physical and sexual abuse is a huge problem. But even children who got through those schools without any abuse were being abused by being forcibly removed from their culture, as well as from their parents, but from the whole...
Well, exactly.
Culture. I mean, this kind of thing happened also in Europe, like in France and England. It was, not only did they colonize the rest of the world, but they suppressed all their own languages. I remember listening to a guy from Wales who said that when he was a child, if you went to school and spoke Welsh, you got beaten.
Yep.
And in France, all of the, like, the Breton language, the Languedoc language, all of those languages got suppressed by Napoleon and ongoing. It's sort of part of this monolithic culture where we all have to do everything the same, speak the same language, eat the same foods.
Yeah, well, you bet. And then, of course, we also see that same suppression within our food systems where we've lost all our seed varieties, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. Yes, we will take the variety of wheat or tomatoes that is most profitable, and to heck with everything else. And so tomatoes that don't look all the same, you're just not going to get them. Anyway, we've coming towards the end of the hour, so I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to add before the end.
Oh, I'm not too sure where all we've been, but
we've been all over the place.
Yeah, but I guess just stressing for myself. The importance of food culture in Indigenous communities. I think that's an important thing to focus on. I think it's the keystone in order to put back together all of the social ills, the addictions, the all those broken relationships. When we can sew together our food culture, when we have our people, those family relationships, a community's sense of oneself, that all comes back together when we have local food culture. And of course, and then even the physical health of people, social health, physical health, spiritual health, all of it, all it's all centered around a local food culture.
Yes. I mean, when I started to learn about a diet, and I realized that the 1950s idea of a low-fat, essentially high-carbohydrate diet, this was pushed on Western culture, which is being disastrous, I think, for the health of Westerners. But that was really being pushed on Native people through the availability of cheap carbohydrates as, you know, in local stores, far from distribution centers, and as sort of charity food. It's a double whammy, because Native culture provided a much richer and more beneficial diet, which has been taken away from everybody. So, yeah, I'm very interested in what you're doing and your perspective on this. And I would like to thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
And I will send you a link to the podcast when it goes up next week. And thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye. It was episode 84 in which we covered the residential schools to which Indigenous children in Canada were forced to attend. Similar circumstances happened in the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and perhaps other former British colonies. Our guest then was James Dashuk, a professor at the University of Regina, which is also in Saskatchewan, like today's guest. The breaking news that Philip referred to was Canadian Senator Lynn Bayak. And for non-Canadians, it's important to know that our senators are not elected. They are appointed by the Prime Minister. So the Senate has become a dumping ground for aging but loyal political apparatchiks. She said, quote, "I speak in memory of the kindly and well-intentioned men and women and their descendants whose remarkable works, good deeds, and historical tales in the residential schools go unacknowledged for the most part," end quote. The kindly people who tore children from their families at a very young age, who underfed them, sometimes deliberately, sometimes as part of scientific experiments, who banned their language and cultural practices, who forced them instead into European language, clothing, and religion, and who in many cases physically or sexually abused them. Worst of all, children died at a higher rate than normal in the residential schools and were often buried in unmarked graves, their deaths hushed up. I suppose if you wanted to, you could find something nice to say about Stalin, Pol Pot, or Hitler, too. Maybe they were nice to their servants. Maybe they had a pet and were nice to their pet. But overall, one cannot see the residential schools as anything but horrific. Thank you for listening to episode 134 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.curro@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us or follow us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.